This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and Vantage Health Plan. 39 days away from the presidential election. These are fascinating times we're in. And next week, the first debate between Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. and Donald John Trump will be held. And the President of the United States continues to reiterate his refusal to honor election results should he lose. These are times like no other. And if you'd like to talk about it, we always invite your input. Our number is 877-217-5757. And please send an email if you wish to talk@talklouisiana.org. Again, 877-217-5757. 4 years ago, the President of the United States received 46.1% of the votes. 53.9% of the people in our country voted for someone else. And 48.2% of the people in the U.S. voted for Hillary Rodham Clinton. But it was not enough. As President Trump received 304 electoral votes, 34 more than needed to become President of the United States of America. Now, he won those states in the Midwest by close margins, collectively by about 80,000 votes, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and that enabled Donald Trump to become the 45th American president. If polls are accurate, Joe Biden is in position to become the 46th president, but much can happen in the last 39 days, and we're not even to October yet, and we all know about October surprises. Last presidential cycle, there was an October surprise, and that was the revelation that Donald Trump had talked explicitly on tape with the younger Mr. Bush about how he pursued women and touched them in their private parts, and it was his voice, and the all-access Hollywood tape really didn't cause President Trump to lose. And of course, we had James Comey announce that Hillary Clinton was under investigation 11 days before the election. He cleared her right before the election, but it may have made a difference considering how close the election was. Will there be another October surprise? The president, of course, wants it to be a vaccine for COVID-19. More than 200,000 Americans have died since this began in the early part of the year, and it is something the president has been criticized for his handling. We know now from Bob Woodward and the president's own words that on the 7th day of February of this year, the president knew how dangerous this disease was, and yet he was telling the American people another story. He says he was trying to avoid panic, but our president has instilled panic in other ways, notably about villains coming across the border and killing Americans. And yet, in this case, he decided to play it down, and we have 200,000 people who are dead. Now, if he had done it differently, we don't know if it would have made a difference or not. Tomorrow, the president goes before the American people and announces his third choice for the Supreme Court. He's already gotten two of his nominees approved, in Neil Gorsuch and also Brett Kavanaugh. Kavanaugh was more controversial than Gorsuch. And this one, if things go according to the game plan, will probably be a 51-49 vote. Democrats, now that they know that the vote is all but a foregone conclusion, may in some cases go the other way. But if they hold true and every one of them votes against the president's nominee, that's essentially 45 votes there. And then we have some Republicans, 47 votes when you count Sanders and Angus King, who are independents who vote with the Democrats. And then when you add Collins and Murkowski, Collins of Maine, Murkowski of Alaska, that makes it a 51-49 vote, which would be the closest vote in modern time, equaling the Kavanaugh vote. Now, Clarence Thomas was 52-48. But tomorrow could be a day of note for the great state of Louisiana. Amy Coney Barrett, graduate of Dominican in New Orleans, Rhodes College in Memphis, and also of Notre Dame Law School, who's now a federal appeals court judge. She could, at age 48, become the nominee and the likely appointee of the President of the United States to fill the seat left by the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Coney Barrett is a arch conservative, and later in the hour we will be talking with Nora Ahmed about this, and she is likely to be supported by every Republican with the exception of Murkowski and Collins. Even Mitt Romney is on board, and certainly John Kennedy and Bill Cassidy will not only support her as a native person if she is the one selected. Barbara Lagoa of Florida is also a strong candidate. But let's face it, Kennedy and Cassidy would support any nominee brought by the president to the high court. And really no questions asked. They are on board with the president. And this is a candidate who 4 years ago in the great state of Louisiana, Donald Trump, received more votes than any person in the history of our state in any election, 58% on the percentage basis, and well over a million in total votes. And he is likely to win here again, but he is showing some difficulty in states you would think he would have locked up by now. The New York Times reports today that its latest polling shows Georgia tied. If the president loses in Georgia, he's in real trouble. And he's only ahead by 3 points in the great state of Texas. And, of course, he has to win Texas. And if he loses in Texas, he's going to be likely defeated in other places. And we will be talking about the landslide that Lamar White predicted the other day. He's predicting that Joseph Biden will receive more than 350 electoral votes. In the headline today, Trump struggles on GOP turf as women favor Biden in poll. And that may in large part be the reason why the president is steadfast in his choice of a woman to be the successor to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but a much different type of woman. If it is Amy Coney Barrett, she not only is conservative, she is a charismatic Catholic. As we know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is a Jewish person, or was a Jewish person, and is the first Jew to lie in state at the Capitol. And today, the nation is paying tribute to the justice appointed by President Bill Clinton in 1993 to succeed Whizzer White, who had been appointed by John Kennedy early in the Kennedy presidency. And even though Coney Barrett will be much different than Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Ginsburg was much different than Whizzer White. Whizzer White was a great football player and a war hero, born just a few days in 1917 before President John Kennedy, actually after him. But he ended up being a conservative jurist. He voted for, against Roe v. Wade in 1973. And we've noted that in the old days, justices often surprised people. But today there is truly a litmus test, primarily on abortion. And we know that any justice appointed by Donald Trump will vote to chip away at Roe v. Wade. There have been surprises. The most recent one was when George Herbert Walker Bush appointed David Souter, and he became a reliable vote on the left side of the political spectrum. And he voted to continue the recount in Florida in 2000 when it was Bush v. Gore. And David Souter was not well liked by conservatives. He ultimately retired, but he did so under a Democratic presidency, meaning a justice of like political philosophy was appointed in his absence. And today we have a case in which just 46 days before the election, Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, and Republicans are rushing to appoint a successor, and they have the votes to do it. And it would not be considered that unusual, except for the fact that the Republicans 4 years ago, 10 months before the election, refused to give Merrick Garland even an interview. He had no hearing. He was just completely discarded as a candidate by Mitch McConnell, who is the Senate Majority Leader in Kentucky, in a tough fight of his own for reelection, but likely to be reelected and to return to the Capitol next year. And the question is whether he will be Senate Majority Leader or Senate Minority Leader. The Senate is also up for grabs. And when President Trump goes out of his way to say he may question the election, he's also questioning the elections of the U.S. senators. So this could be a real mess if the president's beliefs are suddenly embraced by the American people. The headline, as I mentioned, Trump reiterates refusal to honor election results from the New York Times was less than 6 weeks until Election Day. Laws governing how Americans vote remain in flux in many battleground states, with the two parties locked in an intense fight over the rules as President Trump continues to suggest he will challenge any outcome unfavorable to him. The combination of the pandemic, doubts about the capacity of the Postal Service to handle a flood of mail ballots, and an aggressive push by Democrats to expand access to voting rights and counter Republican efforts to limit them has fueled litigation and legislative battles across the country that have not been resolved, even as early voting has gotten underway. We are 39 days from the finish line. Again, your number, 877-217-5757. Talk at talklouisiana.org is our email. And we'll return with more Talk Louisiana after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. And I'm told that we may not be able to make contact with Richard Grant. I hope we can, but he's written a fascinating book, The Deepest South of All, True Stories from Natchez, Mississippi. So let's see if we can get him on the line. But if not, we'll continue to talk about the news of the day. And there is much of that. We have a pandemic. We have riots in our streets. We have unrest with the electorate. And the President of the United States, even though he has never been above board in any of these conflation of polls, he still has about 40% of the country that is wildly in his corner. And that is a formidable group of votes that will be certainly active on November 3rd. And he won in an upset 4 years ago. And I don't think anybody in his or her right mind would rule out the prospect that President Trump could win again. And it's a case in which certain parts of the country are wildly in the corner of the president. He carried all 11 SEC states, for example. I mentioned that he's in trouble in Georgia, potentially. He may end up losing his now adopted home state of Florida. But it would not be surprising that Trump won all 11 of those states again. And if he did, then that means Biden has to win in places like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, maybe Arizona. And we'll see how it goes. 877-217-5757. In the South, as we know, most African-American citizens do not like the president. Most white citizens do. And one of the white citizens of the South who likes President Trump a lot is Coach O, the head coach of the Louisiana State University Fighting Tigers, who will open their season tomorrow with 16.5-point favorites over Mississippi State. Coach O and the president, they melded when the head coach of the Tigers visited the White House with his team, and the president was very nice to them. And, of course, he was effusive in his praise of Coach Orgeron, who registered to vote for the first time last year at the age of 58 and presumably cast his ballot for his other close friend in politics, Governor John Bel Edwards, a Democrat. But the coach's support of the president has caused friction on his team, which, after all, is 85% African-American. And at one point a few weeks ago, his team walked out of a meeting with Coach O. Now, whether any of this will have repercussions tomorrow when LSU faces Mississippi State before about 20,000 people in Tiger Stadium, who knows? But at any rate, many of his players are not on the same page with him politically. And I think Coach O, being naive about politics, although brilliant about football, probably was in the stands, or he saw the stands. He was certainly on the field January 13th when LSU and Clemson played. And Coach O heard everybody cheer with robust vigor for President Trump as he cascaded across the field. And most of the fans in the stands, of over 95% white, most of them from Clemson and LSU, supporters of the president. And the coach may have thought that his team felt the same way the fans do, but obviously they don't. But before we go to the phone lines, Let's hear from Coach O and President Trump about their collective man crushes.
Makes me proud. I love President Trump. He treated us very well. We went to the White House. I think he's doing a fantastic job.
He's all man. He's a big, strong-looking guy.
All right, so there we go. And we'll talk more about this with Ron Higgins later in the hour. But we're joined now by Richard Grant. His book is The Deepest South of All, True Stories from Natchez, Mississippi. And it is a fascinating ride through a part of the country that most of us in Louisiana know well, and we're fewer than 100 miles away from Natchez here in the great city of Baton Rouge. And Richard, on your first day in Natchez, you say you saw the antebellum mansions for which the town is famous, but you also saw the site of the Forks of the Road slave market, which until recently had not merited public mention. And that kind of sets the stage for the book. This is a town that, of course, has many dark secrets and many great wonders.
Yes. The Forks of the Road was the second largest slave market in the Deep South. And somehow Natchez had managed to forget all about it until quite recently, when an activist discovered the not only the existence of the market, but just the scale of the traffic that went through this market. Tens of thousands of people were sold there. And really, every time you look at a mansion in Natchez, no matter how beautiful it is, you're also looking at the horrors of slavery at the same time, because that was the wealth that created all the beauty there.
You say Natchez is as deeply southern as it can possibly be. It's a city of just 15,000 people, beautiful city. And at one time, per capita, it, I think, had the greatest wealth of any city in the United States. What is it like today?
Well, it's a shrinking town, but I don't think it's going to... I think it may revive. Tate Taylor, the movie producer, is trying to get Natchez, trying to get investment in there to make it into a filmmaking center. And it's got so much going for it, a beautiful location on a high bluff overlooking the Mississippi River, and the greatest concentration of antebellum homes in the South, and a beautiful walkable downtown, and some great restaurants and some great bars. It's also kind of got a lot of problems. It's in a very real way trying to deal with the legacy of slavery, which the town was built on, and it's trying to work through not just the racial conflicts that set in place, but trying to find a way to get the tourists in there and deal honestly with its own history.
You focus upon some of the real characters the town has produced. Tell us about Buzz Harper.
So Buzz Harper is kind of a legendary figure there. I think he was 6'4", but people tend to exaggerate. It's 6'8", and he wore four-piece suits, which was a three-piece suit with a matching car coat, and sometimes a floor-length mink coat. A very flamboyant figure, a southern gentleman in all ways apart from his business dealings. He liked to swindle women out of their gemstones. And there was an antique dealer, was a friend of Anne Rice in New Orleans, was a friend of Imelda Marcos, the first lady of the Philippines. And, somebody described him to me as the gayest man in Mississippi. And the fact that he was dead, now dead, didn't seem to invalidate that claim.
The
dead have a real presence in Natchez.
Yeah, and some others do too, including Ginger Highland. Tell us about Ginger.
Well, Ginger is alive and well, and she lives in this outrageous mansion called the Towers. And she and her partner, or her husband James, are convinced that the mansion is haunted, and they run supernatural tours through there. And they're actually very disturbed by the degree of haunting there. It's not just a fun tour. There are spirits to be placated. And then at Christmas, Ginger decorates 187 Christmas trees with her costume jewelry collection. So she's an obsessive collector of costume jewelry and other things, including antique eyewash cups. She has more than 500 antique eyewash cups.
And there's Nellie Jackson. Nellie Jackson is another wonderful character.
Yeah, so I think Nellie Jackson was a brothel madam who operated her establishment right in the middle of Natchez for about 60 years. and became friends with the mayor and various chiefs of police, and there was never really much impetus to close her down, apart from a certain section of the more devout church-going public. But she was tolerated, and she was also a flamboyant figure. She would wear white mink coats and drive a white Cadillac with a white poodle on her lap, and always packed a pistol. She was African American, and during the civil rights era, it was discovered quite recently, she was a secret informer for the FBI on the activities of the Klan. A lot of the Klansmen would frequent her brothel and always want to sleep with black women.
Oh,
and after sex, they would often reveal secrets to the women about what the Klan were up to.
My. The book is The Deepest South of All from Richard Grant. We'll return, spend a few more minutes with him after this pause for the news on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with Richard Grant. His book is The Deepest South of All. It's a fascinating ride about Natchez, Mississippi, a town that we in Louisiana know well, a border town. And city of just 15,000 people, but one that has a rich history, and some of it is sinister, some of it is whimsical, some of it, of course, is majestic. But you note, Richard Grant, that the long history of slavery in the region, from the Natchez Indians who used their war captives as slaves to Forks of the Road, the second largest slave trading post in the Deep South, puts this town in a light that is not so great.
Well, you know, there's no way you can escape the shadow of history in a place like Natchez. Natchez tried for a long time to kind of depict itself as a romantic gone with the wind type of place, but now the town is making an honest effort to kind of grapple with its past. But there's just a lot of past to deal with there. You know, it was also a very rough place during the civil rights era. I think there were more Klan atrocities around Natchez than anywhere else in the South. So I think the town is sort of making good progress on a very difficult mission as far as confronting its own history.
You now live in Jackson, Mississippi. Grew up in London. How did that come about?
Oh, it's a long and winding road, let me tell you. It went through Arizona and Mexico and New York and parts of Africa, and somehow ended up in Jackson, Mississippi. Not quite sure how it happened.
Well, you made the choice, I presume. Nobody put a gun to your
well,
head.
Well, I did.
But guy.
No, nobody put a gun to my head. One thing led to another.
You must like it.
Yeah, I do. I've got some very, very close friends in Mississippi since moving there, and they've kind of become like family to me and my wife.
Well, the book has received great plaudits, and of course, Richard Grant is no newbie. He's an exceptional journalist who's been around a long time, writes for the Smithsonian, the New York Times, and he's also the author of Dispatches from Pluto, which was a New York Times bestseller. So, Richard, I'm sure you're quite pleased with this book. And considering the issues that are ongoing in our country right now, it is certainly timely.
Yeah, I mean, I was researching this book in 2016, 2017. And there was a lot of talk then in Natchez about, about the Confederacy, about monuments, about the legacy of slavery, about racism, about how to handle all of this stuff. And then by the time I finished writing the book and it was about to be published, this had turned into a national conversation. In a way, sort of, Natchez is a little bit ahead of the nation in talking about all this stuff.
Well, the South, after all, does have the largest proportion of African-American citizens, the most number of African-American office holders, and we have many problems with race, but we also have lived with each other for a long time. Are there signs that are perhaps encouraging amid all the turmoil in our country right now?
I mean, I really look to the South as kind of a, a place where people are more honest about race than they are maybe up north or out west. I mean, I think things are sort of more out in the open in the South. And if the South can make progress, that would kind of set the tone for the rest of the nation, I think. And that, you know, there are signs. I mean, one of the most striking things on that first day in Natchez, you know, I ran across this slave market, and then I saw all these mansions. I heard that there were two garden clubs that had been feuding viciously with each other since 1935. I was getting a lot of information. But then I found out that Natchez had just recently elected a gay black man as mayor with 91% of the vote. And he campaigned on a platform of, we need to get beyond black and white and focus on the color green, meaning economic development. And the fact that he won with 91% of the vote, I think, says a lot about Natchez.
Well, Natchez may be the most progressive city in the great state of Mississippi, and you've captured it in all its majesty and, of course, all of its tragedy. We've had Stanley Nelson, the great reporter who lives in Faraday, who's captured many of the unfortunate killings, tragedies of the 1960s.
Yeah, amazing, amazing reporter Stanley is.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you got to know all the characters in that part of the world, and he is one of them. But Richard Grant,
yeah,
congratulations. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yep. No, he was one of the characters I would have loved to get to know that I didn't. But I have a greatest respect for him.
We appreciate your work. Richard Grant, the book is The Deepest South of All, True Stories from Natchez, Mississippi. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you very much.